From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eric Idle was a founding member of the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus. He has a new CD in which he performs some of the songs he wrote during his years with the Pythons. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature a 1999 interview with Idle in which he sang some of his Python songs and a few others. And film critic John Powers reviews American Psycho, the new movie adaptation of the controversial novel by Bret Easton Ellis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The U.S. relatives of Elian Gonzalez have asked a federal court in Washington to keep him from leaving the country until the government can certify that his human rights wouldn't be violated if he returned to Cuba. The latest legal move in the custody fight over the six-year-old is based on the United Nations Charter on Human Rights. The government asked a federal appeals court to give no more help to the boy's great-uncle, Lázaro Gonzalez, until he surrenders the boy to his father. The boy's father remained in Washington for a ninth day. He has said that he'll remain in the U.S. with the boy until the legal issues are resolved. President Clinton waded into the election year debate over education today with a speech criticizing Republicans for a big tax cut the president says would take money away from schools. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Education is a battleground issue in this year's presidential race, with George W. Bush making inroads with repeated speeches on an issue that used to favor Democrats. In a speech to a group of education writers in Atlanta, Georgia, President Clinton criticized Republicans for proposing to spend $100 of the surplus on tax cuts for every dollar they spend on education.
The problem is, even the apparently appealing plans advanced by Republicans are in trouble because of the combined impact of their proposed tax cut and defense spending increases.
President Clinton also spoke out against another Republican proposal, vouchers that would allow parents to use taxpayer-subsidized education dollars to pay for private school tuition. Mara Liasson, NPR News, the White House.
The government of Ethiopia accused other countries of being slow to help millions of people in the country facing famine. According to the UN special envoy to Ethiopia, those millions of lives could be saved if food and money arrive immediately. Mike Donkin of the BBC reports from Ethiopia.
Prime Minister Meles Zenawi says his government sounded the warnings in good time, but the West chose not to hear them. That's an accusation that's accepted by some aid experts here. They simply could not believe predictions that thousands were at risk in the remote and sparsely populated Ogaden Desert. So they hung back, says Ben Foote of Save the Children, to check for themselves.
Unfortunately, it's very difficult to go and check, partly because of the terrain and accessing these people who are moving. They're not settled. So it's very difficult to assess anyway, and even more difficult if you're being shot at. So the situation caught up with us.
The present emergency is a long way short of the 1980s famine at the moment, but it could escalate rapidly if the Ethiopian government and the donor nations don't work swiftly together.
Mike Duncan of the BBC in Ethiopia. In stocks, the Dow Industrials lost 616 points today, or 5.6%, to close at 10,307. This is NPR News. Stock prices plunged today after the government announced an unexpectedly big jump in consumer prices in March. The Dow and the technology-heavy Nasdaq suffered their biggest single-point losses ever. Analyst Tony Dwyer of Curlin Securities said the sell-off could be viewed as an opportunity.
Most people are really having a difficult time in this market because it keeps going lower. However, for the longevity of the secular bull market, it probably is healthy and should have been expected.
Dwyer said stock should be back at realistic prices. Microsoft is acknowledging that a security flaw in a previous version of its internet software could leave some websites vulnerable to hackers. But the software giant is denying a report that the problem was deliberately written into the software as a so-called backdoor by Microsoft employees. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
Security experts are concerned that the hole in Microsoft's internet server software could let hackers gain entry to internet sites where they could steal credit card numbers or other private information. According to a report in the Wall Street Journal today, the breach was created as a so-called backdoor by Microsoft engineers several years ago, who included in the offending code the phrase "Netscape engineers are weenies." The report said the code was apparently written at the height of the rivalry between Microsoft and Netscape. But Microsoft officials are denying that the security problem was placed intentionally by its engineers. Instead, a company spokesman says the flaw is simply the result of out-of-date software code. Chris Arnold, NPR News, San Francisco.
And I'm Corey Flintoff. This is NPR News in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations, Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Eric Idle was one of the founding members of the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus, which was known for its bold, lunatic, intelligent, and irreverent style of sketch comedy. Now Idle has a new CD called Eric Idle Sings Monty Python Live in Concert. On this archive edition, we have a 1999 interview in which he performed some of the songs he wrote during his years with the Pythons. Idle spoofed the music of the Beatles in the film The Ruddles, All You Need Is Cash, a mock documentary that he worked on with Neil Innes. Now Idle co-stars on the sitcom Suddenly Susan as the magazine publisher. It's the series' final season. I spoke with Eric Idle last fall after the publication of his comic science fiction novel The Road to Mars, set in the 24th century. The main character is an android named Carlton, who's writing a thesis on the nature of comedy and uses old Monty Python tapes to do his research. Eric Idle's experiences as a new author inspired him to write a new song, which he performed at the beginning of our interview. Here it is.
Now, this is predicated on the fact that whenever you tell people you've written a novel, they say, oh, is there going to be a film? Because the people are too lazy to read, really. The book of the month, the book of the year, the book of the bloody day will soon be here. Spring, summer, winter, fall, the books keep coming and I buy them all. But I'm waiting for the film to come. Memoirs of a Geisha, everybody's heard of it. I bought that and read about a third of it. I must confess, I didn't get a word of it. I'm waiting for the film to come. I'm waiting for the film. I'm waiting for the film. I'm waiting for the film to come. Angela's Ashes, I tried hard to begin it. It's so wonderfully Irish. I cried every minute. I guess we should be grateful there's no river dancing in it. I'm waiting for the film to come. Jackie Collins' latest, I'm not a man to grovel. Sex, sex everywhere, from a palace to a hovel. In fact, it's so damn sexy, it's a 13 Kleenex novel. I'm waiting for the film to come. I'm waiting for the film. I'm waiting for the film. I'm waiting for the film to come. Monica Lewinsky, the tubby White House Venus, has finally spilled her memoirs of the presidential penis. Her dress was the only thing not taken to the cleaners. I'm waiting for the film to come. Eyes wide shut, I'm really not a prude. I like Nicole Kidman, especially in the nude, but I didn't understand it. In fact, if I'm quite rude, I'm waiting for the book to come. I'm waiting for the book. I'm waiting for the book. I'm waiting for the book to come. The Road to Mars has a robot who is plucky, looking at comedians and just what makes them yucky. You can find an unsigned copy if you're really very lucky while you're waiting for the film to come. Waiting for the film, waiting for the film, while waiting for the film to come.
That was wonderful.
Thank you. Am I past the audition?
We'll call you.
Thank you.
Don't call us. Well, that's a wonderful song, and you think people are waiting for a film adaptation of your new book, The Road to Mars?
It's what they always say, you know. They say, oh, is it going to be a film? So who knows?
In your novel, the android who's writing his thesis on comedy discovers Monty Python tapes and has some thoughts about their humor. I'd like you to read that excerpt for us.
So Carlton is doing research into the comedians of the 20th century, and he's looking in particular for a comedy gene. He thinks he almost finds some evidence with one of the guys on a very weird show called Monty Python's Flying Circus. I've seen the tapes, and boy, does it suck. It's strange rather than funny. Five limeys and a yank. No girls, they did drag. Typical Brits. They're never happier than when dressing up as women. What is it with them? It's a stupid show, as I say, and Carlton found it totally puzzling. Heads come off or pop open in demented animations. Sheep drop on people's heads for no reason whatsoever. Vikings sing love songs to pressed meat. Weird men dressed as old ladies squeak in silly voices. There are dead parrots and Spanish Inquisitions. It's all very silly nonsense. They seem dangerously cuckoo to me. Carlton couldn't make head or tail of it. But it seemed from the tape that the audience laughed. As far as he could tell, it was genuine, not canned laughter. In casually cross-checking the genetic backgrounds of the six strange men involved, he turned up an ancestor for one of them in showbiz. Eric Idle's great-grandfather, Henry Bertrand, a Victorian gentleman from the 1890s, had been a circus manager. Was this the genetic missing link? His great-grandfather was a ringmaster in a circus, and Idle was in a flying circus? Surely this was significant. Of course it wasn't. Turned out Idle was screwed up by losing his RAF rear gunner father in a traffic accident in World War II. Irony, eh? Killed coming home from on Christmas leave after surviving the war. This was compounded by being stuck in a semi-orphanage for 12 years with a bunch of fatherless boys. The circus thing was just a coincidence, but you can see the lengths he went to in searching for the comedy gene.
Well, thanks for reading that excerpt of your book, The Road to Mars. And before I get to some of the things about your biography that are referred to in that passage, I want to ask you a little bit about the comedy of Monty Python. I mean, it looks ridiculous to Carlton centuries after the fact. He doesn't understand at all the surrealism and visual and verbal non sequiturs that the Python's comedy was based on. And I'm wondering why you think that so much of the Python comedy was based on surrealism and non sequiturs.
Well, first of all, Carlton doesn't get it because he's an android. He doesn't get much.
Good point. Thank you.
He has no sense of irony whatsoever. And if you tell him to say, people say, like, get out of here, he leaves the room. And that's part of his problem, really. He can't understand the secondary levels of meaning in language, which is where comedy lurks. And also, it's kind of fun to sort of abuse Python from the future. It's kind of a nice, comfortable position to look back at our own work.
But getting back to the question of why so much of the Python humor was about surrealism and visual and verbal non sequiturs.
I think that we thought it was reality. I think that that's the way we look at things. I mean, it isn't really non sequiturs. The world doesn't make much sense, and we always try and pretend it does. And comedy's job is to point out that it doesn't make any sense and it doesn't matter that much. And perhaps we reflected that a bit.
I thought we could take a break here and listen to another one of your songs. And this is a song that was done in the Monty Python movie, The Life of Brian. And the song is Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. Set up for us how this song is used at the very end of The Life of Brian. And Brian is somebody whose life parallels the life of Jesus, and he ends up crucified on the cross at the end of the movie. Tell us about the song here.
Well, we had to face a complex problem of how to deal with all our characters. We're heading towards crucifixion, and we had to, there was no way of getting out of it. It was a common form of death for the Romans. It was like public hanging, you know. So we knew they were all going to have to die, and we couldn't face how could we deal with this image of the crucifixion. And we knew we were going to have a lot of people crucified because the Romans were fond of mass crucifixions. And so I said, well, let's do a song, you know, and it should be a cheery song. And so we thought the idea of people sort of singing a rather bright song as they're being crucified, because they've got a couple of days, was a kind of wonderfully British sort of way of looking at things. And so I went off and I just came back and wrote this little quick little ditty, which has become an anthem in England for the many times we lose at sport.
And of course, in the movie, your character is getting crucified as well, and you kind of kick off the song, and then all the guys getting crucified join in.
Yes, it's a rousing experience.
Would you sing it for us?
Sure. Some things in life are bad; they can really make you mad. Other things just make you swear and curse. When you're chewing on life's gristle, don't grumble, give a whistle, and this'll help things turn out for the best. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps, just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. And always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the light side of life. Cause life is quite absurd, and death's the final word. You must always face the curtain with a bow. Forget about your sin, give the audience a grin. Enjoy it, it's your last chance anyhow. And always look on the bright side of death. Just before you draw your terminal breath. Life's a piece of shit when you look at it. Life's a laugh and death's a joke, it's true. You'll see it's all a show. Keep on laughing as you go. Just remember that the last laugh is on you. And always look on the bright side of life. Come on. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on the bright side of life. Always look on that bright side of life.
That's a great song, and I love the way you do it. I love the whistling, that little trombone sound that you get at the end there. That's new, isn't it?
Well, I've always been able to do that. It's kind of a boarding school thing. When you're stuck at boarding school for 12 years, one of the things you learn to do are silly and pointless things that help to pass the time. So I can do, you know, I can do horn, French horn, and various things. I've used them on records too. It's cheaper than musicians.
My guest is Eric Idle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1999 interview with Eric Idle, recorded after the publication of his comic science fiction novel, The Road to Mars. Now he has a new CD called Eric Idle Sings Monty Python. You've done your share of Saturday Night Live shows. How would you compare the Pythons and Saturday Night Live?
I think they're completely, totally poles apart. They're completely the opposite. I mean, Saturday Night Live, we would work 9 to 5, write every single word before we ever went shooting or taping. Saturday Night Live, they come swanning in on a Tuesday, try and write in the middle of the night. If they get a concept, they're happy with it. They never heard of a rewrite. And they, you know, sometimes the sets are built before the scripts come in. So it's very hit and miss stuff, you know. So often they'll get a great concept. In fact, we used to have a joke about them. It was rather cruel. They said, what's the difference between life and a Saturday Night Live sketch? And the answer is, life doesn't go on forever.
Wow.
But they you know, it's a great academy for talent. Don't let me put down Saturday Night Live. I think it's a wonderful thing, remarkable. Without the talent that's emotional in that show, the entertainment scene in America would be bereft. I mean, it's just produced breathtaking amounts of great comedy. But they, in terms of writing, it's just, you know, it's almost childish. They never get to have a second go at anything and improve it. They sort of get there, and it's all a mad panic to put the show on. They never do anything preparation. So that's exactly the opposite of what we did. We were always very tight and anal. You know, our films we'd write for 2 years. We'd do for 5 or 6 drafts before we even would begin to start trying to rehearse it.
Do you think that has to do with the fact that you were all from a background of having not only written college plays and performed them, but having written for, like, BBC Radio and things like that, where things had to be tight?
I think we were all writers. I mean, that's essentially, it is a writer's commune. You know, and what we were very good at was criticizing each other's work. That was the safety net. So nothing went through without us at least thinking we thought it was funny. So that's a great safety net. And it was a good criticism going on. If you'd gone past the point of being interesting in a sketch, people would say, you know what, it stops there. Let's take it in a different direction. Or what if you did this? Because we've all got the idea. We've got the drift. So that was, I think, what was really unique about Python is we were a great group of self-criticizers. You know, there were 6 people in there, and much didn't slip through the net that wasn't at least up to a certain standard.
That kind of criticism, though, isn't great for friendship, is it?
Absolutely, it is. I mean, it was fine. People didn't, you know, that was what was great about it. You could say, I think that script is a load of rot, and still go out to lunch. Now, where are we going to go have lunch? It wasn't a personal thing. You were encouraged to say exactly what you thought. That was the other thing about Saturday Night Live. You could never be totally honest because they say, well, we have to leave that in because the girls don't have much this week. You know, there were secondary reasons for leaving material in. We were ruthless about that. No, it doesn't matter. And we'd never cast it until we'd done the script. So people couldn't say, oh, I need to keep this because I've only got this little bit. We would do the bits first and then we'd cast it.
Now, I want to get back to the reading that you just did from your novel, The Road to Mars, in which Carlton the android has discovered Monty Python tapes and he's viewing them from, the 24th century and trying to figure out what those tapes are about. And he reveals that Eric Idle's great-grandfather was a circus manager. Is that true?
Yes, he was a ringmaster in a circus in Victorian times. And I have some programs printed on silk where they did gala performances for Queen Victoria. And his name's on it, you know, it says General Manager Henry Bertrand. When I was a kid, I was taken to circuses in Manchester and where people still remembered him. He was a kind of a big figure in circuses, and I was treated with great respect and allowed to stand by the ringmasters, who are the guys who wear the red costume with the top hats. And it was wonderful, actually. And it never occurred to me that I was still in a circus until years after we finished Python. And I went, wait a minute, it was Flying Circus, because we call it Monty Python, you know. And I thought, well, why isn't that weird that I was in a circus too?
Was this something, the circus connection, something that your family was proud of or embarrassed by?
I don't have much family. My background is very disjointed, and I was sent off to boarding school. And, you know, so I was always very proud of it. It's great when you look back and see your... I've got pictures of Henry Bertrand, and, you know, he was a manager of all these acts, including, you know, Robie's Flying Midgets, which I'm really fond of as an act. And so a lot of this sort of... to me, when I was thinking of this book and the show business in the future, he was an inspiration because I put in some of the acts, you know, trying to invent future acts. You know, I would be based them on past acts.
So did you come up with the Monty Python Flying Circus name?
No, that sort of revolved in a very weird way. We called it Gwen, you know, it was called Bun Wacket Buzzard Stubble and Boot, Owl Stretching Time. It had all these silly names. And the BBC always called it, you know, Barry Took's Flying Circus, you know, because the guy was, you know, they just thought it was some kind of some flying circus. And so we came up with the name Gwen Dibley. Michael came up with that. We didn't think that was a good enough name, but it was a neighbour of his mother's, and he wanted her to be surprising when she opened the newspaper and saw she had her own show. But in the end, we thought, you know, somebody came up with the name Python, and then I came up with the name Monty, because it was this guy in a pub who was always wore a bow tie, and people said, has Monty been in? Hey, where's Monty tonight? You know, it was this sort of Jack the Lad kind of thing, and it sounds like a seedy agent. And so this year, actually, I did a piece for the reunion concert thing, which we didn't really reunite, but which it will look like that, where I did a whole biography of Monty Python and asked that this year, to celebrate the 30 years, wasn't it time that the Queen knighted him and he became Sir Monty Python?
Great. Great. Now, your father died in World War II?
Yeah.
What were the circumstances of his death? He was killed on the way home?
Well, it's just kind of ironic. You know, he was in the RAF from 1941, and he was a rear gunner in a bomber, in bombers and things, and that's a very dangerous role. And then they were coming home on leave, and they said, well, don't use the railways, they'll be crowded, it's coming towards Christmas time. You guys should hitchhike, because everybody gave the forces rides when they're in uniform. So he got a ride, and he was in the back of a lorry, a truck, and a car swerved and cut in front of them, and they went off the road, and he was crushed, and he sort of died on Christmas Eve. So it was kind of bitterly ironic, you know.
And I don't know how to say this exactly, but it kind of feeds the sense of tragic absurdity.
It certainly gives you a sense of irony. Of course, I was two and a bit, so I didn't really know why Christmases were so miserable and depressing. It really affected my mother. She never actually recovered from it. And she went into a bleak depression. And part of my theory in the book is, and it's not just my theory, people I went into research a bit, is that comedians are formed by maternal abandonment and that they seek to replace some kind of parental love that they're not getting by being cute and funny and doing anything to entertain and solicit this love and this laughter from strangers.
And so that's your theory about why you became a comedian?
It probably accounts for why I did. I noticed on the playground with my daughter, who's nine, that when I go in there, I can tell which kids don't have mothers at home because they're being funny.
Eric Idle, recorded in 1999 after the publication of his comic science fiction novel, The Road to Mars. Now he has a new CD called Eric Idle Sings Monty Python, which will be released next week. We'll hear more of his interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
So how do I cope with this shattering news? Well, philosophy. Whenever life gets you down, and things seem hard or tough, and people are stupid, obnoxious, or daft, and you feel that you've had quite enough, just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving, and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 19 miles a second, so it's reckoned the sun that is the source of all our power. The sun and you and me and all the stars that we can see are moving at a million miles a day. In an outer spiral arm at 40,000 miles an hour of the galaxy we call the Milky Way.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Additional support from guru.com, staffing short-term projects in a variety of fields, including creative, technology, marketing, and strategy. Guru.com. From REI, providing outdoor gear and clothing for muscle-powered adventures since 1938. Stores nationwide and on the web at REI.com. And from Random House's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Lamb in Love by Carrie Brown. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our conversation with Eric Idle, one of the original members of Monty Python's Flying Circus, and John Powers reviews the new film American Psycho, adapted from the Bret Easton Ellis novel. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our 1999 interview with Eric Idle, one of the founding members of the British comedy group Monty Python's Flying Circus. Idle has a new CD called Eric Idle Sings Monty Python, which will be released next week. When we left off, he was telling us that his father died in a freak accident during World War II when Eric was 2 years old. So you were sent to a boarding school that you've described as a semi-orphanage. In what way was it like an orphanage?
Well, it was an orphanage until the week before I got there, and it changed its name. It was the Royal Orphanage, and it became the Royal School. And what happened was I was sent there, and the RAF paid for my education, and they just took over this orphanage, and they sent all the kids who had lost fathers. So I grew up in, it's a very bizarre thing to do, I grew up with a whole group of kids who were stuck into this sort of horrible Victorian orphanage at seven. With none of them had a father, or most of them didn't have a father. So we had no sense of what fathers are or were.
Did you do plays and music and showbiz kind of things in boarding school?
No, absolutely. I used to have puppets, and we do puppet theatres and write and perform, and we were voices off. It's very much like what I do when performing. I'm very much more comfortable in makeup and with wigs and moustaches and beards. It took me a long time to become an actor who can just be just me or closer to my physical looks without some kind of disguise.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know when I was in public school in the States in grade school, one of the songs that we had to sing when we were in assembly was All Things Bright and Beautiful. And you wrote a very funny parody of that song. And I'm wondering if you had to sing All Things Bright and Beautiful when you were in boarding school?
Absolutely, and it always struck me as being wonderfully ironic. You know, it's like, well, what about all the other stuff in that was created? Was that not created by God too?
Can you sing us a little bit of All Things Dull and Ugly, your parody of All Things Bright and Beautiful?
I shall try. All things dull and ugly, all creatures short and squat. All things rude and nasty, the Lord God made the lot. Each nasty little hornet, each beastly little squid. Who made the spiny urchin? Who made the sharks? He did. All things dull and cancerous, all pox both great and small. Putrid, foul, and gangrenous, the Lord God made them all. Amen.
That's very funny. Did you write that while you were in boarding school, or did you have to get much older and more sophisticated before writing that?
No, I was older and should have known better.
Now, what was the comedy that influenced you during your formative years?
As I grew up, radio was comedy king in England. We'd hear a lot of comedy on the radio. The Goon Show was very big. And then when television finally appeared, because I grew up without television until I was about 12, I loved Dick Van Dyke and I loved Bilko very much. And we got a lot of American comedy. But the thing that really changed my life was in 1962, I went to see a show in London called Beyond the Fringe, which had Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, Jonathan Miller, and Alan Bennett. And it was the funniest single review I have ever seen. And I just rolled around, and it changed my life. I learned all the words, and it suddenly made clear to me that all the authority I'd been suffering under was absolutely a load of nonsense. And my instincts to be subversive were absolutely right. And that these people were funny, and they were imposing their views of life on you. The military, the church, the teachers, all of this was actually mockable.
Were you in the military?
Well, at school, at boarding school, and every Monday you had to be in the army from the age of 12.
Oh.
And so, you know, they'd dress you up in military costume, and I could strip a Bren gun blindfold by the age of 14. And, you know, put it back together again in the dark. I could crawl. They taught you crawling through places and camouflage. I was firing these huge anti-aircraft guns at 16.
Hmm.
And then, sort of the age of 18, I went on the Aldermaston March, and they said, well, you can't be in the army and do that. And I said, well, I'll leave. And they said, you're not allowed to leave. So I was like, oh, right, fine. So that's when I left school, really.
So before this revelation, when you saw Beyond the Fringe, did you accept authority and obey authority?
No, never. We were always new. We were always climbing over the wall and going off to meet girls and going down to buy beer and cheese and have a drink. You know, we were very highly organized criminal life. There was a girls' school right next door to us, and it was part of the same school, but they pretended they didn't exist, except on Sundays when they came to church with you, because there was a lot of compulsory church. There were two on Sundays. And so what we do, we organize it so well. If you wanted to go swimming at night with the girls, you put your name on a list, and then somebody would wake you up at about 2 in the morning, and you'd go and meet them. We'd pick the lock of the swimming pool and go there and have parties and then go back. I mean, it was quite extraordinarily subversive.
Did you ever play in a rock band or a folk band when you were a teenager?
I grew up playing the guitar. It was one of the great things was Elvis sort of gave us all great heart and hope and the Everly Brothers. And so when I was 14, Elvis came into my life. And then I had to have a guitar, and we would play folk music. We'd play a lot of, Negro spirituals and things. And we identified very much with the black slaves of the south part of America. And we'd sing all these,
Let my people
songs
go.
About Jim Crow. Exactly. We were totally identified with that. It was very interesting. And then, I played a bit of harmonica and guitar. And then eventually, when the Beatles came through, everybody tried to play pop music. And that's when I got into that.
Let me ask you, if you would, to play a few bars of a song from the old days, a song you used to do as a teenager.
What do you do? If you're white, you're all right. And if you're brown, stick around. But if you're black, oh brother, get back, get back, get back.
Good. So were you doing that at like folk clubs and things?
Well, at school. No, we didn't go out to folk clubs.
That's right, right. Like,
Sonny Terry and Brownie McGee were huge. I love them. They're uh-huh. so great.
Uh-huh.
Big Brunsy, all those sort of folky things.
Interesting. Well, you went to school in Cambridge, got into the performing group Footlights, mm-hmm. where you met some of the other Pythons. You became the president of Footlights, and I read that the first thing you did was to initiate a bill allowing women to join this theater club. What inspired you to open it up to women?
Well, I mean, it was fairly absurd. This club had been going since 1883, and they didn't allow women, into the club. It was absurd. So being a kind of radical kind of 60s thing, I said, no, we absolutely have to admit women. We want to have funny women. We need them for the show as well as anything else. And so a lot of gay dons wept and beseeched me not to change anything. They love these. They're all called Binky and love little men dressed up as ladies and pretty boys singing frightfully witty lyrics. And I said, no, it's absolutely not. This is the 20th century. We have to. And the first woman to join who came through the door, which you could believe it or not, was Germaine Greer.
Oh, no. That's funny.
And she was...
I wouldn't think of her as excelling in comedy, but...
She was hilarious. She'd
really?
Come out of Melbourne University, and she was really funny, and she'd come on stage dressed as a nun and start to strip.
Oh,
and
wow.
She'd do this nun strip, and then she'd put on flippers and go off for a swim. It was kind of an innocent turnaround.
Huh.
But we went on tour at the end of my last year with a show called My Girl Herbert, and she was in it. And she was tremendous fun. I loved Germaine.
Now, the funny thing is that you opened up the doors of Footlights to women, but, of course, the Pythons had no women in the group. Why didn't you want women in the group?
Well, it's not a question of why didn't we want them. There wasn't a woman that we knew who was from the background that we were drawing our pool of chaps from. I mean, it's a conflation of two shows, Python. There was a kid's show called Do Not Adjust Your Set, and there was a show called Not the 1948 Show. At last, it's the 1948 Show. And, if there had been a great writer, performer, woman, she could easily have been in it. But there wasn't. She wasn't around. This person wasn't there. And so, Germaine was writing books. It's actually easier for a group of men to get on. I mean, I know that later comedy shows that had women in had a lot more trouble because people have affairs, they fall in love, then they have arguments. That doesn't actually happen in a group of men so much. They tend to get on with it.
Of course, this left the Pythons to play the women's parts themselves. What kind of woman do you think of yourself as having specialized in?
Well, I used to play one version or other of my aunts, where there were four aunts, and they were all and various qualities of class structure. And I used to play very much the upper-middle class aunt, type of aunt, because I like those. And also, you don't have to alter your voice terribly much to be in their sort of register and timbre, you know? And I like that sort of very English, rather correct lady who's very, very well-mannered and polite but rather firm.
It's funny that, you know, as much as there was a lot of, like, drag humor in the Pythons, the women weren't, it was never, like, sexy women that you were doing.
Well, whenever we wanted to use sex, we would get a real woman in, because it's confusing if you're doing, unless you're doing sex with inverted commas, if you wanted to actually have a real sex issue, then you have to get a real woman. And that's where we found Carol Cleveland. We brought her in specifically for a sketch where I was a marriage guidance counsellor and Palin brings his wife in and I start having sex with her during the session. And it really doesn't work if it's a guy in drag because there's some other whole other issue going on. The subject doesn't work. And Carol was brought in and she stayed with us throughout. So there was a woman with us, but she wasn't a creative. She didn't write. So she wasn't really part of the gang.
My guest is Eric Idle. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Ouch, you're breaking my heart. Ouch, I'm falling apart. Ouch, 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 ouch. When we first met, I must admit, I fell for you right from the start. Now when we meet, all kinds of things, it seems upset the apple cart.
Let's get back to our 1999 interview with Eric Idle, recorded after the publication of his comic science fiction novel, The Road to Mars. Now he has a new CD called Eric Idle Sings Monty Python. I think, you know, your most famous Python sketch is the Nudge Nudge Wink Wink sketch, two men meeting for the first time in a bar. Did you write this sketch?
Yes, I did write the sketch.
Tell us about how you wrote it.
I wrote it for another show. I wrote it for Ronnie Barker, who was one of the two Ronnies. And I sent it in to some Frost show. And they sent it back unused because, of course, if you look at the script, it's incredibly boring. There are no jokes in it. It says, is your wife a goer? Know what I mean? Know what I mean? Say no more. Say no more. Nudge, nudge. Know what I mean? Say no more. Nudge, 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 nudge. It just comes straight back. And then I thought, well, that was rather funny. So I read it out at one of the really early Python meetings. Say, is your wife a goer? Eh? Know what I mean? Say no more. Say no more. Know what I mean? Nudge, nudge. Eh? Wink, wink. Eh? Is she a goer? Eh? Does she go? Eh? And, of course, they fell about because it's kind of in the performance. And it's sometimes it's very hard to read comedy scripts. That's why Hollywood is so notoriously bad at reading comedy scripts, because it's often in just as the way you do it. I mean, I once picked up a Cleese sketch, a headmaster sketch, and I thought, there's nothing funny about this. And then I saw him do it, and he just reduced me to tears.
What kind of guy inspired this sketch?
The Nudge Boy is very much an English wide boy. He's, you know, he's down a pub. He's always down a pub, and he's, you know, he's a bit of a jack the lad. He rather fancies himself. But, of course, it's rather sad at the end, you know. He says, you know, you've slept with a lady. Yes. What's it like? So he's sort of kind of, he's that irritatingly nudgy person that really people don't behave like if they are well-behaved.
Well, let me play the Python sketch.
Your wife interested in photography, eh? Photographs, eh? He asked him knowingly.
Photography,
yeah? Snap, snap, grin, grin, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, say no more.
Oh, holiday stamps.
Could be. Could be taken on holiday, could be. Swimming costumes. Nudge, nudge. Candid. Candid photography.
No, I'm afraid we don't have a camera.
Oh. Still. Oh! Eh? Eh? Oh!
Look, are you trying to insinuate something?
No, 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 no. Yes.
Well?
Well, I mean, you're a man of the world, aren't you? I mean, you know, you've been around, you've been there.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, like, you've done it, with a lady. You've slept with a lady.
Yes.
What's it like?
So after the sketch, Eric Idle, did people come up to you for years and do the whole nudge, nudge, wink, wink thing?
That's still probably the most quoted to me, yes. And people love it so much, I just enjoy doing it. So in my stage show, I'm doing him a bit more.
Mm-hmm. Now, before the Pythons, you wrote for radio. You wrote for David Frost's show. You wrote for the game show. I think it's a game show. I'm sorry, I'll read that again.
No, it's
a
comedy show.
Comedy show. No. Did you write gags?
No, I'm sorry, I'll read that again. Came out of Cambridge, and it was a Footlight show, and we went onto the radio, and it was very surreal, and used a lot of silly humor. John Cleese was in it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Graham Chapman was in it for a bit, or wrote for it. And there were like long, extended sketches of weirdness that I used to write when I was trying to be an actor in the repertory theater. And in fact, they found one night I was writing a sketch away, and the guy comes up into my dressing room and he says, "Eric." And I said, "Hello." He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "I'm writing." He says, "Oh, is it funny?" And I said, "Yeah, I think so. I think it's quite funny." He said, "Well, would you mind joining me on stage?" I'd miss my entrance. He'd come to get me. I realized I wasn't cut out for acting at that point.
One of the great things that you've done over the years is The Ruddles, which was a really wonderful parody of The Beatles that you put together with Neil Innes. And, there's a fake documentary and, mm-hmm. and an album, and you did The Ruddles on Saturday Night Live. What impact did The Beatles actually have on you? You said before that you switched more to pop from folk during that. But tell us more about the impact of The Beatles growing up in England.
The Beatles totally changed England. They came through Cambridge in 1963 when I was there. And before then, people wore sort of tweed jackets with little leather pads on their elbows and were very sort of pretending to be public school a lot. And then suddenly the Beatles came through and people were wearing leather jackets and discussing who was their favourite Beatle. And they had an enormous effect on England. It was like an overthrowing of all the dull, boring music of the 50s. And suddenly live, vibrant music, which belonged to the teenagers, came out and was suddenly took over everything. And it changed radio, it changed television, it changed clothing, it changed habits. Whether they caused it or there were symptoms of a cause, it totally changed everything.
Would you do an excerpt of one of the songs that you wrote for The Ruddles?
Well, let me be very clear. I didn't write any of the songs for The Ruddles. They're all written by Neil Innes, and they're wonderful. But when I did my gig at the Getty recently, I did my first appearance as Sir Dirk McQuickley, who has now been knighted, and I did sing a song. So let me just try and thumb through it. I feel good, I feel bad, I feel happy, I feel sad. Am I in love? I must be in love. I'm in doubt, I feel sure, I feel rich, I feel poor. Do you think I'm in love? I must be in love. Any time of the day I can see her face when I close my eyes. Ooh. Am I rich or alive? Can my poor heart survive? Do you think I'm in love? I must be in love. I must be in love. I must be in love. Thank you.
Oh, that's wonderful. Did your pronunciation change when the Beatles started singing too? Like there was one loof in there for love.
Well, I for a time lived in Wallasey, which is just opposite Liverpool. So I tend to have a natural, slightly uh-huh. northern accent. Uh-huh. And I have a great pal who was a Beatle. So whenever I'm with him, I talk like that, you know. So, yeah, that's right. We talk like that now.
Oh, George Harrison.
I'm a bit of a parrot. Yeah, George. I'm a parrot. If I stand next to Billy Connolly for long enough, I'm talking like this, you know. I'm out of Scotland. It's a dreadful thing, being a parrot.
Eric Idle recorded last fall after the publication of his comic science fiction novel, The Road to Mars. Now he has a new CD called Eric Idle Sings Monty Python, which will be released next week. At the end of the month, he begins a performance tour. Let's hear a song from the new CD. This is The Meaning of Life.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to a rather stupid evening. Why are we here? What's life all about? Is God really real? Or is there some doubt? But tonight we're going to sort it all out. But tonight it's the meaning of life. Oh, what's the point of all these hoax? Is it the chicken and the egg time? Are we just jokes? Or perhaps we're just one of God's makers? Well, sassy, the meaning of life is life just a game where we make up the rules while we're searching for something to say? Or are we just simply spiraling coils of self-replicating DNA? In this life, what is our fate? Is there a heaven and hell? Do we reincarnate? Is mankind evolving, or is it too late? But tonight, it's the meaning of life.
Coming up, John Powers reviews the new movie American Psycho. This is Fresh Air. American Psycho is a new movie based on the controversial novel by Bret Easton Ellis. It's directed by Mary Harron, who co-wrote the screenplay. Our film critic John Power says he threw the book down in disgust. Here's what he thinks of the movie.
Shortly before American Psycho premiered at Sundance last January, a producer walked up to filmmaker Mary Harron and gushed, "I just love your work." "Thank you very much," Harron politely replied, "but maybe you should wait until you see this movie. You may not like it. A lot of people don't." Then again, a lot of people do. For American Psycho is the kind of movie that divides people even more surely than the name Bill Clinton. Christian Bale stars as the film's narrator, Patrick Bateman, a Wall Street hotshot in the late 1980s who appears to have it all. Cerruti suits, platinum credit cards, enough designer toiletries for all the Backstreet Boys. But beneath this perfect surface, he says, "I'm simply not there." Like the other young masters of the universe, he derives his identity from scoring reservations at the hot new restaurant or having a more chic apartment than his colleagues. Yet such status symbols can't fill Bateman's sense of hollowness or check his sociopathic immorality. For him, mergers and acquisitions is no different than murders and executions. He uses the terms interchangeably. And so he kills people, especially women, with knives, axes, even chainsaws. Bret Easton Ellis' novel was intended to satirize Reagan-era greed, but he wrote it so ineptly that it was merely vile. Its idea has been redeemed by Harron, who specializes in brainy, aestheticized versions of tabloid material. Her first film was I Shot Andy Warhol. From American Psycho's witty credit sequence of red drops falling against a white background, it's not what you think, to its ravishing evocation of Manhattan's sinister sheen, Harron has turned the movie into a triumph of style. And a funny one. She sharpens Ellis's original jokes and delights in comic detail, be it Bateman playing Huey Lewis's hip to be square as he slaughters a rival, or his constant use of the boot-sized cordless phones that were an emblem of 80s success. Here, Bateman and his colleagues measure their masculinity by comparing their personalized business cards.
"New card. What do you think?"
"Oh, very nice. Look at that."
"Picked them up from the printers yesterday."
"Good coloring."
"That's bone. And the lettering is something called Cillian Braille."
"It's very cool, Bateman, but that's nothing. Look at this."
"That is really nice."
"Eggshell with Romalian type. What do you think?"
"Nice. Jesus. That is really super. How'd a nitwit like you get so tasteful?"
"I can't believe that Bryce prefers Van Patten's card to mine."
"But wait, you ain't seen nothing yet."
American Psycho is filled with jocular violence. But it's not amoral like its hero. In fact, Heron gives Bateman's story a clear feminist underpinning. The movie builds to the scene when he tries to kill someone we care about, a beleaguered prostitute played by the brilliant young British actress Cara Seymour. Suddenly, our laughter dies away, and the story turns genuinely chilling. Heron has transformed Ellis's novel into a horror film for women, and not simply because Bateman kills them. He and his Brill Cream buddies invariably talk about their girlfriends as if they were cuts of beef or tradable stocks. The movie's a clever commentary on vain, vacuous masculinity, which may be one reason why men largely dislike it, and women tend to enjoy it. The other is surely the presence, often scantily clad, of Bale, whose lean, mean performance should forever free him from the wistful observer persona acquired in pictures like Little Women and Velvet Goldmine. Not only does Bale perfectly emulate a stock market stud, he consciously mimics 80s male icons Tom Cruise and Charlie Sheen, but he finally has a role that exudes sexual danger. Heron is the first director since Spielberg, who cast the 13-year-old Bale in Empire of the Sun, to grasp that the actor's real strength is his suggestion of hidden madness. There's darkness lurking in his eyes. Watching his sly, menacing turn as Bateman, I thought how much more talented Mr. Ripley would have been had he been played by Christian Bale. Although it boasts one fiendishly clever joke about Manhattan real estate, the movie loses steam in the last half hour, as satires often do. We get the point, and Bateman's not a rich enough character to produce any great epiphany or catharsis. By the end, I found myself wondering why Heron wanted to tackle Ellis's book in the first place. She's so much smarter and more talented than his one-note material. But I don't want to begrudge her very real achievement. Only her second film, American Psycho, isn't just a clear advance over I Shot Andy Warhol. It's the best possible adaptation of a novel famous for being despised. Heron has turned a sow's ear, well, not exactly into a silk purse, but let's say a Prada bag, the kind that a man like Patrick Bateman would kill for.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, and Patty Leswing. Research assistance from Brendan Noonan. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From ExxonMobil Corporation, sponsor of ExxonMobil Masterpiece Theater, presenting a new adaptation of Charles Dickens' David Copperfield, Sunday on PBS. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. And from Island Records Def Jam Music Group, featuring I Am Shelby Lynn, from new recording artist Shelby Lynn. Available in stores or on the web, www.islanddefjam.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, actor Edward Norton. His movies include Fight Club, American History X, The People vs. Larry Flint, Everyone Says I Love You, and Primal Fear. He directed and stars in the new comedy, Keeping the Faith. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.